Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor. I'm your host, Daniel Pope. This podcast is brought to you by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Practice Group, and it's a place for thoughtful conversations. We have conversations ranging from the latest developments to perennial topics like litigation, enforcement, and compliance assurance. We're glad you're spending some time with us today.
We're excited to welcome Matt Tejada to the podcast. This name is probably familiar to you. As we've discussed on this podcast before, environmental justice has been one of the signature policy goals of the current administration. But as our guest will be able to explain, environmental justice is not a concept that was defined by this administration. It's been around for a long time. And we're going to discuss how this administration has fared in expanding the EPA's focus on environmental justice, as well as the role that non-governmental organizations can play. So welcome, Matt. We're so glad that you've been able to join us. We're also joined by Stephen Cook in our Bracewell Houston office. Thank you both for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us.
So, Matt, my first introduction to you came right after COVID started. And I think you were doing a remote CLE for the Austin Bar Association on environmental justice. And I think this was right after EPA had finalized a series of updates to the EJ screen tool. And you were talking about the importance of environmental justice and encouraging companies and lawyers and agencies to make use of that tool. And so I think that must have been right at the beginning of COVID when everybody scratched their CLE in-person events and went remote. It seems like we've come a long way in environmental justice from those days. A lot has happened over the past 4 years. A lot's happened with you moving from being director of the Office of Environmental Justice to a deputy assistant administrator role in a new office. And now you've moved on to the Natural Resources Defense Council. Tell us about what the past few years of change have been for you.
Yeah, it has been an incredibly dynamic several years. And to me, as somebody who's not actually a lawyer or a scientist or an engineer, my academic background is mostly in history. I think this has really been the most historic period in our lifetimes, in our generation, certainly going back, I would say, to a lot of the social evolution and upheavals of the 1960s. We've lived through a watershed, both in terms of the administration changes, the real differences between the two administrations that we've had come on top of one another, going back, I would say, to the Obama presidency. Everything that the pandemic really did highlight for folks in terms of a lot of inequities and disparities that exist across the United States, and that being thrown into real sharp relief, especially in those early months, that first year of COVID. Everything we had with Black Lives Matter, and really for the first time since the 1960s, and some would argue, I would probably argue even more so than in the 1960s, a real broad societal readiness to begin to have some tough conversations that we've never, frankly, had in the United States about the persistence of things such as racism and classism in our society, in our government structures. And then on top of all that, to have a presidency come in that's not just lifting up those issues, but giving some real political mandate behind it. And then at the same time, getting unheard of, you know, once in a lifetime resources from Congress to actually go out there and start working on systemic issues of disinvestment, of infrastructure development and rehabilitation, of really starting to salve some very open wounds that have been there for generations. It's been an incredible several years of change and priority and highlighting what has not happened for a very long time. And now our opportunity to really make leaps and bounds of progress as quickly as we can.
You mentioned funding. Let's jump into that real quick, because I know Stephen is interested in the Community Change Grant Program that was just established, I suppose, as you were transitioning out of your role at EPA. You talked about unprecedented resources. Tell us a little bit about those grants and where we are in issuing grants and coming alongside communities.
It goes back to, I think, the Build Back Better agenda. When that early in the Biden presidency, there was talk of Build Back Better. And at that time, I think people were talking about $5 billion in the Build Back Better for environmental justice. And that was really breathtaking to me. Just thinking about billions specifically for equity and justice was the first time folks had dared to dream that big in a lot of ways, I think. It was also, though, to me, as the person who had been running the EJ program and the EJ grants at EPA for close to a decade at that time, there was this huge opportunity, which is exciting. But then there was also this very real, oh my gosh, nobody's ready. And that's not just from the government side. I'm really thinking about out there in the space of community organizations and collaborative partnerships that communities have with, you know, their tribes or their local governments or academic institutions. The level of capacity readiness out in the space to act on a multi-billion dollar opportunity was kind of scary to think about that in the very early parts. And then unfortunately, as happened, the Build Back Better agenda kind of bifurcated and we got the bipartisan infrastructure law and all of that EJ money, as well as so much of the just really critical technical assistance that communities and their partners needed in order to make use of that infrastructure money went away. It kind of fell out of that, of the bipartisan infrastructure law. So when the Inflation Reduction Act came back around and it had that money, it had the technical assistance, it was really the opportunity to finally get in the game, right? And to do it in a way that so many folks outside of government and so many of us who were in government at that time, we really knew that that technical assistance and trying to ease the barriers that are all throughout government grant programs and funding programs to try to remove those barriers and connect that money to the communities that really needed it the most, that had the greatest need based upon historic disinvestments, based upon just the fact that they're facing some of the biggest health challenges out there. It was a really dynamic time of trying to stand up different programs. So we immediately started kind of unpacking how could we use that money in different ways to really meet communities where they were at. So it was even before the Inflation Reduction Act passed, we decided at EPA we were going to use a significant chunk of our annual EJ appropriation to stand up what we saw as the kind of the backbone of providing assistance. And that turned into the Thriving Community Technical Assistance Centers. So we used annual appropriations to get those things out there, because even before the Inflation Reduction Act passed, right, we knew that communities were going to need technical assistance to go out and get the bipartisan infrastructure law money. Mm-hmm. So we had started building out those TIC-TACs first to be that ground floor front door for communities to start getting the help they need to write better grants, to lay out an annual budget, to build partnerships with their local government institutions. And then from there, when we got the Inflation Reduction Act, it was like, okay, now we can really start to do some stuff, right? And the next thing that we knew we wanted to do is communities that lack that capacity, that haven't been part of these government funding systems for so long. They needed the leg up to have the technical assistance to build their capacity, but they also just need access to capital. They just need access to a couple $100,000 so they can actually get together with their tribe and they can get together with their local government and sit down and make a plan. Mm-hmm. Somebody's got to pay folks to do that. So we established the Thriving Community EJ Grant Makers to try to reduce some of the burdens that communities and their partners, like local governments and tribes, face when they're trying to get that money just to do that very fundamental work of building collaborations, of putting together multi-partner projects and proposals. So the grant makers are out there now to really help build that runway to match the technical assistance of the TIC-TACs and lift up hopefully thousands of additional community-driven partnerships to be ready for kind of the crowning achievement of it all, the thing that I was desperately working to get out the door before I left EPA, the community change grants. Because those are out there for those communities that really have some capacity already. They can manage a $10 to $20 million grant. They're already working in collaboration with their local institutions in their state, and they need that. They need that next level of funding to really start actually putting infrastructure investments on the ground to make change happen in terms of dealing with environmental legacy issues of pollution and also getting ready for climate change. And whether that's climate mitigation activities, trying to, you know, get more CO2 or methane or other greenhouse gas emissions out of the atmosphere, or I think even more importantly, just getting their communities ready to adapt to the changing climate, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that is because of flooding and sea level rise or heat, which folks are fast waking up to the fact that heat is a really challenging issue. It's going to be a really catastrophic issue for a lot of communities that we can start working on now. So there's a lot of opportunity out there with this money right now for communities for the first time ever to build their capacity and to really start putting in place the sorts of projects that they design on the community side to best meet the challenges that they are facing.
Well, it's kind of interesting. A couple of things you said made me think about one of the things we've talked about on this podcast before, which is that what we're seeing with this administration and the sort of changed emphasis on environmental justice is, I think, a kind of a pivot from what I think of as like sort of procedural environmental justice to what we've talked about a little bit before as substantive outcomes for environmental justice communities. I think in the past, EJ has been a little bit more like advising agencies to ensure that people can participate. Mm-hmm. It's been less focused on achieving those outcomes. And maybe part of the dynamic with the ability of communities to respond to these grant opportunities, for so long, EJ has just been about that procedural engagement. It's show up to a meeting, but there's not going to be any funding for you to work with a consultant to figure out what might need to be done around a contaminated facility or something like that.
Yeah, no, I think that is absolutely right on. I mean, the two pillars that the government has always really focused on in terms of its environmental justice work have been the concepts of meaningful engagement or meaningful participation and what we now call just treatment. It previously in Executive Order 12898 that President Clinton signed back in 94, mm-hmm. they called it fair treatment. That has been updated to just treatment. And there's a whole very good reason why those two words were kind of swapped out for one another. But those are the two pillars, right? You have to meaningfully involve people in decisions, and then your decisions have to answer what you hear in that involvement. And for decades, the government has really focused on that first pillar, right, of meaningful engagement. Not having hearings at noon in the fancy hotel downtown on a Wednesday because nobody can show up to that from the communities that are actually being impacted, right? So you have to go have that hearing in a place that is comfortable to those folks at a time that they can show up. You have to make sure you have interpretation available. If there's English access issues, you might even have to show up and be ready to provide childcare or other things to really make sure you're meaningfully engaging with the community. And it has to be early on in the process so that they have confidence that their voices are really going to be heard at a time when they can influence stuff. So we've come a long way on that, right? It's still certainly not perfect, but it's a heck of a lot better than where we were 20 and 30 years ago. That other concept, though, which Dan, I think is what you were really getting at, is that just treatment, right? And that the decisions have to reflect what folks tell you in those opportunities to engage. Not that the decisions have to turn into these yes, no binary, we're not going to do something or we're going to do something, but your opportunity to modify the decision, to mitigate for factors, or at least to explain, like, we heard y'all talking about these things, but because of technology or because of other environmental concerns or because of economic concerns, right, the decision is going to go in a different way, and here's why. At least having that level of transparency and accountability in the actual decision making. At EPA, we were pushing towards that place, especially with the leadership of Lisa Jackson in the first part of the Obama administration. And we never quite got to that place where we were really making different decisions. So it's been a really big focus in this administration, whether it's things coming out of the White House and the Council on Environmental Quality, or just the day-to-day decisions that agencies, not just EPA, but across the federal government are making. Like looking at Department of Energy and really trying to make sure that in a lot of their programs right there, they're centering efforts on having community benefit plans and community benefit agreements to make sure projects really are going to answer the needs of local communities. Looking at the programs that we designed at EPA before I left, that community change grant had huge involvement, and folks were really hopefully pretty pleased when they saw the final product that we did everything we could to innovate to make sure that grant program really answered what folks were asking us to bake into that grant. And then beyond that, right, looking at just decisions that are happening, rulemakings, standard setting, permitting, it's got a long way to go. Right. Those decisions, I'm not saying those decisions are all perfect by any stretch yet. They've got a long way to go. But I feel like over the last couple of years, this is the first time we're really finally starting to see government, and not just the federal government, but state government and local government, really examining issues of, well, who is benefiting? Whose concerns are being addressed? Why aren't we addressing other folks' concerns? And how can we do that in the way that we're advancing water infrastructure systems or wastewater systems, in the way that we're deploying technologies to monitor for environmental quality, right? In the way that we're actually taking up citizen complaints about issues and being responsive to them. I think government really has turned a corner that I think it's unlikely for government to come back from. right? It's but now we're finally starting to get our hands into, you know, the inner work of how government can really evolve to be a more equitable and just government for everyone in this country.
Matt, you kind of took the grants in kind of two buckets. You had the $100,000, I think you used, just to figure out how to apply for the grant. And for people who have never looked at government grants, you generally start with about 20 pages of instructions
right
before you ever get to the first page where you start filling out immense, tedious information.
Yes.
And it's very imposing to communities. So I think that's pretty self-explanatory, trying to just figure out how to fill out the form in a way that it'll get these competitive grants. Then the next bucket you talked about, you know, could be $2 million, $10 million. What do you envision a community doing with that money? Talk to us a little bit about what does success look like? They gotten to that point, they have that. What's changing? What are they doing?
One of the reasons, one of the good parts of having left EPA is I can now sit down with potential applicants and I can kind of share with them and listen to them about, you know, how are they putting their projects together. So some of the folks that have come to me recently, just to kind of share what they're up to, you know, folks are looking at how can they work with a collection of churches throughout their community. Looking at a Black community. So looking at a dozen Black churches in their community. And these are communities that get hit fairly often by severe weather, by heavy rains, by hurricanes. So communities are constantly struggling with resilience in face of severe weather. So they're going to work with those churches and they are going to work to make sure that not only can they serve as kind of refuges in times of high heat, but that they have renewable energy. They have some upgrades to their infrastructure across those 12 churches so that they can survive floods, they can survive high winds, and they can be resilience hubs so that people throughout those communities know that in times of disaster, they can go to those facilities and they'll have protection. And at the same time, when you're making improvements to that number of kind of large buildings in a community, then you're really bringing in a lot more green infrastructure into that community. You're bringing in solar panels. You're bringing in potential upgrades to utility systems in that area that's going to make it much more likely for things that have really been tough to penetrate, Black and brown communities and low-income communities, things like solar, rooftop solar, and other forms of renewables. You're starting to bring that infrastructure into their community so you can support the further build-out of it. There are other folks really looking at, which is going to be exciting, is going to be an area of real innovation, is, you know, if you're bringing renewable energies, if you're bringing infrastructure improvements, if you're bringing green infrastructure and flooding mitigation into these communities, there's a lot of jobs in that. And we want those jobs to be performed by folks in the local community so that the wealth that is potentially there can be retained by the local community. But they need a lot of workforce training. They need a lot of trying to get a leg up in those systems. So this, for the first time, is EJ organizations and their partners have access to capital to build in those sorts of workforce training systems that will work in and with and for those communities. So that's another thing that's featuring, talking to some folks in some more rural parts of the United States recently. They're kind of doing the same thing. They're looking to bring solar in. They're looking to redevelop some abandoned mine lands. And throughout that entire project, they're looking to rehabilitate some older buildings in a number of communities in these rural areas to be workforce centers and to be workforce training centers so that there can really be a pipeline of folks ready to do those things like restoration of abandoned mine lands and putting in flood mitigation and then putting in green energy, especially in areas in rural parts of the United States where you don't have a lot of other opportunity, especially in times of disaster. These could be real game changers for those communities. And it's funding these sorts of projects at a scale that makes them real, but they're still possible for those communities, right? They're not looking at $500 million projects. They're looking at kind of community scale projects where they can really test this out. They can figure out how to make these sorts of projects work together in their communities with their local partners. And that's the sort of stuff that I think that kind of around $10, $15 million, that makes those sorts of projects possible without being overwhelming.
We spent a lot of time talking about community change grants, EPA initiatives, and you're not there now, right? You've moved on to NRDC. And I'd love to hear what you're hoping to accomplish in this change for you. But I'm also curious, this administration has focused on EJ so much that I think part of that conversation has been watching what's happening at CEQ, what's happening at EPA, right? So I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on what role organizations like NRDC play in environmental justice, especially when EJ is such a highly community-driven effort. You've talked a little bit about this already. I want to hear you expand on it. How do larger nationwide organizations come alongside very specific, very local communities with, in many ways, like sort of very unique considerations and support those efforts?
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot in there. So when I joined EPA in 2013, folks were worried if I'd last 12 months because they were like, who's this kid from Texas, been running around Houston, he's an EJ advocate. He's never going to be able to adapt to the government. And adapt I did. I got in there and managed to survive and figured things out. But honestly, I had never anticipated that I would spend as big a chunk of time in the administration as I did. After having adapted and kind of figured out how to exist and how to continue to push from inside of the government, there was just a succession of kind of challenges that I felt it was my responsibility as the senior career official in charge of the EJ program that I had to be there to see the program through. And those challenges didn't stop until really the Inflation Reduction Act passed. And I'd been itching for a little bit to get back out on the outside and get back into a pure advocacy role. But just these huge opportunities kept coming down the pike, right? The executive orders and Justice 40, and then we got $100 million for the EJ program. And then we got the Inflation Reduction Act, and we were turning the office from just an office of environmental justice into a national program of environmental justice and external civil rights. I mean, it was just one challenge after the other that I wanted to be a part of and that I wanted to see through. And it also just kind of fit my nature a little bit more, where I tend to, I guess, appreciate chaos a little more than most folks. I like being in kind of messy spaces and figuring things out and innovating and building, and maybe have to tear something down and try it again. I'm pretty comfortable in those spaces. So I had a lot of that throughout my career. But after having stood up to help stand up the EJ National Program with very good colleagues like Lillian Dorca, who's been running the External Civil Rights Program at EPA almost as long as I'd been running the EJ program, you know, it really got to an inflection point of, you know, okay, so I had the opportunity to build more things than I ever thought I'd be able to build. And we had some new leadership on board, and it was just one of those pivotal times where I was like, well, I can stay here and I could operate these things that I've built and continue to kind of push our government to be more just, to be more equitable, which I felt like we were really doing for the first time in a long time, right? There's been kind of these inflection points in government, like when President Clinton signed Executive Order 12898, when Lisa Jackson came into EPA. And I felt like this administration was another huge inflection point that really helped us push forward. So I could stay and keep doing that stuff, or I could get back out on the outside. And especially with all of these programs landing, you know, across the United States, I felt like I could be a lot more useful, serve a deeper purpose by being on the outside, helping communities, helping their partners understand the opportunity, understand how to take full advantage of the opportunity to make these programs work for their communities. And also to go back to, you know, the last part of your question, I've been really fascinated with the environmental groups and the environmental movement for a long time. I mean, I had my experiences with environmental organizations when I was running the Air Alliance Houston down in Houston, which is the organization I used to run, you know, and didn't have very good experiences typically with environmental organizations. So used to really get chafed a lot with folks parachuting into Houston and not really committing to it, not really establishing themselves there, rolling up their sleeves and getting into the dirty work with us. But I felt like, going back to the beginning of our conversation, these last few years with a lot of change and a lot of readiness to have a conversation that folks had never really embraced before, the environmental movement's been a part of that. And the environmental movement has finally started to make, I think, some real decided progress towards being a more equitable and a more just movement. And that's not to say that the environmental movement is ever going to be the environmental justice movement. It shouldn't ever be that. It should never try to be that. The environmental movement certainly needed to reckon with a lot of its own histories, which there's plenty of tough stuff in those histories, both from the foundings of the environmental movement, just to more recently, the environmental movement still supporting positions that were at odds with Black and brown communities across the United States. And I, throughout that time, I'd been really curious about NRDC, because NRDC was one of the groups that never parachuted into Houston on me. It was actually when I left Houston early on in my time there, we were trying to expand the portfolio of the organization I was running, because it was really focused, as Stephen knows, it was really focused on petrochemicals and refineries and chemical plants. And I was like, there's this port over there too, right? There's a lot of trucks and ships, and like, we should really be focusing on them, don't you think? So we started going out to Southern California to learn from some other really awesome EJ leaders and EJ organizations out around the ports of LA and Long Beach. And there was this organization that was always in the back of the room. They always had a couple lawyers in the back of the room. It was NRDC. And they weren't in there setting folks' agenda for them. They weren't in there trying to tell folks what to do. They were sitting in the back of the room like, we're here to support you. This is what we can do. Let us know when you're ready and we'll do it. And I was fascinated by that. I was like, wow, an environmental group is finally showing up kind of in the right way here. And that's not to say, again, that NRDC did that for everyone. NRDC has had its own experiences with plenty of communities where things have been tough and things have not gone that way. But I really felt like NRDC, especially with some leadership that's come in to the organization recently, with Manish Patna, who is the CEO now, really wanting to take NRDC into a next evolutionary phase, not just, I think, of NRDC, but of the environmental movement, and really understanding how to occupy some ground that is really tough to occupy, to show up authentically for the communities that we work with. Right. And to provide the value that we can for environmental justice and for environmental justice organizations, the perspective that we can bring as a national environmental organization, the expertise that we can bring. Right. And to provide that and work in partnership with EJ organizations in an authentic way, where our agendas, that doesn't mean our agendas all just merge into one overall agenda, but our agendas can't conflict with one another. Right. We can't keep doing things that are at odds with our brothers and sisters in the EJ movement. I felt like there was a real opportunity to solidify that and to take that and to help through NRDC to really take the environmental movement into a more equitable and just place. And so far, you know, from being inside of NRDC now for a few months, I'm very hopeful, and I'm very encouraged that this is the direction that NRDC is going. And I hope to be a part of helping the organization to be a more powerful, more equitable and just organization, not just for NRDC's purposes, but for the purposes of the environmentalism in the United States and internationally.
Matt, you've mentioned local communities. You've mentioned the national, environmental, federal government. What role is there for the industrial sector, whether it's the clean energy developers putting out the solar arrays in the middle of the reservation, or for the petrochemical plant refinery, or oil and gas drilling? Where do you see, as this momentum and this money rolls out, the role of industry, if you will, using that term broadly?
Sure. They have to be in the room, and they have to be at the table. And that's something that I think, going back to the early days of environmental justice, there's as tough as it can be, I think there's always been an acknowledgement that in order to make progress on these very real issues of Black and brown communities and low income communities and indigenous communities historically being dumped upon and being marginalized and disinvested in, you can't solve for those generational issues without everyone being in the room, right? And everyone having a seat at the table. And the private sector is absolutely a part of that. I think one of the clearest manifestations of that, which is really critical to its power, is the fact that the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, the NEJAC, one of the first kind of institutions of environmental justice that the federal government established and has supported, has always had private sector, heavy industry members on that body, right? Their voices have got to be a part of it. It takes some bravery, and it takes knowledge and maturity for representatives from the private sector to be able to show up in those spaces in a way where they understand they don't get to set the agenda in the room. They've got to be just a part of folks coming together around a table to focus on the community's issues. But folks are doing that. And I think increasingly folks in the private sector are recognizing that not only from in terms of their bottom line, and not only in terms of the desires of the employees throughout their private sector organization, their investors, the communications of what the company is doing. I think the private sector is really waking up to the fact that it's going to have to make progress at understanding how to show up in those places more regularly and how to be that partner that communities need. And right now is an incredible time for companies that have that bravery to kind of stick it out there and model some of that behavior, because there's going to be communities all over the United States right now receiving funding to do things they've never been able to do, right? The private sector can't be the recipient of that, but the private sector sure as hell can be a partner to it, right? If communities want to bring in renewable energy, if they want to deal with issues of flooding, if they're having to deal with issues of relocating parts or all of their communities because of things like sea level rise, to figure out real entrepreneurialism that works for the community. So whether that's workforce training for these green jobs that are coming or other forms of entrepreneurialism and wealth creation and retention for those communities, these projects are going to give the opportunity to innovate and actually implement things that help those priorities become realities. And to the extent that the private sector, you know, can actually go in and work in partnership with their community partners and with their local governments and tribes or whoever else is a part of it, and play a positive, constructive role would be great. I mean, one of the things that I know that some of the things that EPA are going to have to contend with, they're going to be coming up against issues of transportation and transit. They're going to be coming up against issues of housing, right? That the EPA grants themselves are not going to fix. So that means that communities are going to have to, they're going to have to go to their local transit board. They're going to have to go to their local housing authority. And if when they go there and when they show up and say, look, we just got an EJ grant, we got $20 million. We want to do rooftop solar. We want to do some flooding stuff. We need this, that, and the other. But look, we need your transit plan to change just so much to work with us on this. Or, hey, housing authority, like, we need you to prioritize some of your funding to match the things that we have going on, because then they can leverage one another and we can make this project even better. That's all really well and good. If the private sector walked into the room with those communities when they go talk to the transit authority or the housing authority, and the private sector is like, yeah, this would be great. Like, we support this. We want to be a part of this. We are here in partnership with our community partners. That would be huge. Like, I remember, Stephen, when we were in Houston still, I remember fighting a local transit authority that was going to shut down a bus stop for one of the Ship Channel communities because it was the only bus stop in that community and nobody ever took it. And we fought for a year trying to get them not to shut that bus stop down because it was the only stop that took people to the only medical facility that they could access. And we had to fight that fight by ourselves, right? And I believe that fight would have been over in a matter of minutes if we had some of the big private folks walking into the transit authority with us saying, you can't take this bus stop down, y'all are out of your minds.
Well, that is so interesting to learn about, but I want to steer us in maybe, I guess, a little bit of a less optimistic direction for this podcast. And maybe it's not less optimistic, but I think that there are some real challenges with environmental justice across administrations. And I can't think of anybody better to ask these questions to than you with your experience. I mean, this administration has made EJ a priority, like a primary focus, not just for EPA. I mean, this is a all of government approach, and it's led to enforcement initiatives. EJ has shaped proposed rulemakings. So what happens and what is an organization like NRDC to do when an administration changes from an administration like this one that's just fantastically supportive of EJ to one that is less supportive, or maybe even just sort of, they're not going to eliminate roles at EPA over a change in policy, but they're going to slow walk EJ, right? What's the role for NRDC there in accounting for those policy shifts and filling in the gaps?
I think that's a great question. And it's obviously, in an election year, it's something everyone's already thinking about, right? Gaming out different scenarios based upon what different outcomes we could see later this year. But there's absolutely every potential, regardless of, you know, which way any of these elections go, for us to continue to make progress on protecting the environment, for us to continue to take action on climate change. And again, increasingly, I think that's going to move into a venue just from primarily thinking about mitigating against climate change to adapting for the changing climate, because no community is going to escape from the changing climate. And and increasingly communities every day are waking up to the fact like, ooh, like we're going to have to make some real changes to how we live and where we live because we can't just keep doing it this way. So there's going to be lots of those opportunities out there. And the thing that I always focused on at EPA and that I'll continue to focus on at NRDC is that it is our jobs to figure out what are the biggest opportunities to keep moving the ball forward, right? Regardless of what administration is in there. And also, and this is something that I am particularly hopeful that I'll be able to help with should the administration change again, is that sometimes when administrations change, people stop showing up. People stop going to those government agencies. And that's the most important thing anybody can do, right? Is to show up in front of whether it is political appointees or the career bureaucrats in those places. People have got to keep showing up because decisions are going to keep getting made, right? And so maybe it might be a little tougher. Maybe the prospects for getting the exact decisions in the exact way that folks want, maybe you have to be a little more opportunistic around those. Maybe you have to really pick and choose your battles, but there are still battles to be fought up and down the line. And people have got to show up and be ready to do that. And I think if you look back at the history of environmental justice at EPA, well beyond my time there, it's a real testament to the fact that we have had folks, whether it was Clarice Gaylord at the very beginning of the EJ program at EPA, or you know the leadership of Charles Lee through so many years of the EJ program at EPA, folks, regardless of administrations and political cycles, have worked to find the areas where they could make progress on advancing equity and justice and advancing environmental protection for the communities most overburdened and most oppressed in our society. And NRDC now, with its increased kind of vigilance and focus on equity and justice as an issue, as we go into this next administration and administrations beyond that, just continuing to have that expertise of looking across the national landscape and what are the biggest issues out there. Right. Like right now, we're very involved in working on PFAS because PFAS is just increasingly, you know, going to be such a challenge for so many communities to deal with these forever chemicals that are now in their water systems. They're in their land. They're worried about their children being exposed. So continuing to look at, you know, we're going to keep working on PFAS regardless of what the administration is. So how can we at NRDC continue to work in league with communities and community leaders as we advance protection against PFAS? Looking at things like lead, there's been some incredible improvements on lead in drinking water recently, right? And we have a draft rule that EPA has put out. If you're looking for one of those manifestations of real just treatment in a rule, EPA finally put some stuff in the lead and copper rule that folks have been asking for decades, because it'll really start to protect the folks that are most vulnerable to lead in their drinking water. So that's now potentially going to become a reality. So how can we take that in any future administration? And let's get the lead out of the rest of the environment too, right? Let's really go back to looking at lead in paint and lead in toxic sites and lead in consumer products that still come into this country or are manufactured every day that are affecting children, affecting adults with lead contamination, right? There's still going to be huge opportunities regardless of the administration change. It's just how do you recognize those things? How do you frame them up? That's the role that NRDC can play and will continue to play. And then also, how can we make sure that the folks out there who are being impacted still have the support and the encouragement and the partnership of organizations like NRDC to keep showing up regardless of which administration is in place?
I may ruin Matt's reputation here by admitting that he and I had some conversations while I was at EPA about how do we keep this going under that. And if you look at the prior administration had opportunity zones. It was a big focus as to the tax cut. And so if you overlaid opportunity zones with EJ screen communities and such, huge overlap. So by going and approaching the problem, going through the opportunity zone door, you still could get to those communities and make changes.
Yeah.
And so there are opportunities, regardless of what administration's there, to go in there. And one thing about the infrastructure and IRA funding, getting these communities to understand how the resources, to understand how the government works and get these grants and get that, you can mesh with any administration's priorities and still get focused on making changes on the ground in these communities.
Yeah.
And that's part of the, and you're right, Matt, I really struggle with the fact it was tough to get the environmental movement to come and talk to us while we were there.
And we did tremendous work on the Superfund program while you were at EPA. I mean, that was a real opportunity, right? And we really, even before I left EPA just last fall, some of my Superfund colleagues were still talking about the progress we had made while you were with us, Stephen. I mean, it was tremendous. We did things in the last administration that previous administrations had declined to consider. So there's always an opportunity, but it takes folks being willing to talk to one another, to work with one another, to meet on open field, and to continue to have the courage to look in the face, to meet face to face with the individuals, with the human beings who are most being impacted by our decisions, and to make sure that they know what their realities are and what they need the government to do, regardless of who is in that government chair. They need to see the face of the impacted community.
And I suppose that going back to the importance of showing up, Matt, back in Warren County, North Carolina, right, where the birthplace of environmental justice, the activists there were not extended an invitation to show up. They just showed up and took initiative that way. So thank you so much. This has been an incredible conversation. It's been really interesting to hear your insights, given your tenure at EPA and your collaboration with Mr. Cook. That's fun to hear a little bit about. And also just helping us to understand the role that NGOs like NRDC have to play in EJ has been super helpful. So thank you for spending a little bit of time with us here. It has been a real treat. Thank you, as always, Stephen. I think you're getting close to getting like a letter jacket with a big microphone on the side. I don't know if people still do letter jackets, actually. I haven't seen a legal specific letter jacket, and there are probably good reasons why. But anyways, thank you both for being with us. And thank you to Emily, our producer, who makes us sound way better than we do when we're recording. And thank you to you, the listener, our audience. We wouldn't do this without you. And we'll talk to you soon.